Welcome to the debate. You know, when architects design a massive modern skyscraper, they build in what are called firewalls.
Right.
The concept is incredibly straightforward. It's rooted in pure structural engineering. Like, if a fire breaks out in the commercial section on the bottom floors, that physical structural barrier prevents the heat and flames from spreading to the residential suites up above.
Yeah, the whole safety of the building relies on that separation.
Exactly. The entire safety of the building and, you know, the peace of mind of every single person living in it relies on that absolute impenetrable separation. But, I mean, imagine a scenario where the owner of the building insists on leaving a few stairwell doors open between the floors. The owner argues that, well, a fire isn't likely to spread anyway. And besides, closing the doors would disrupt the daily flow and the convenience of the residents.
But the residents, in that scenario, I mean, they would spend every single day smelling the faint scents of smoke. They'd be constantly wondering if the alarms were about to go off.
Right.
It creates this perpetual state of anxiety about the structural integrity of the very building they live in. Even if there isn't an active inferno, just the mere possibility of one enabled by those open doors, it completely changes how everyone behaves.
And that structural anxiety, that tension between the absolute safety of a closed door and the practical reality of leaving it open, that is the exact lens through which we have to view the focal point of today's discussion.
Absolutely.
We are diving deep into Chapter 22 of this incredibly comprehensive project, the Trump Dossier 2015-29, which was created by Bridge2's Dice. And this specific chapter is titled The Trump Family as a Business Empire.
Yeah.
Across a 14-year period.
And it is arguably the most consequential chapter of the entire Bridge Thieves project, because it touches on the absolute bedrock of institutional trust.
Right. The central question we have to grapple with today isn't just a political one. It's structural. We have to ask, did the massive, unprecedented growth of the Trump family's business empire from 2015 to 2019 represent a legitimate continuation of a private enterprise?
Which is a family's fundamental right.
Right, a family's fundamental right to conduct business in a capitalist society. Or, on the flip side, did it irrevocably blur the lines between public service and private enrichment, fundamentally and, you know, permanently altering the ethical baseline of the American presidency?
Well, my reading of the historical data and the legal architecture of this era suggests that the Trump family operated entirely within their legal rights. I mean, they successfully and practically delegated daily operations while driving immense economic growth and navigating new markets.
But at what cost?
Well, they did it all without any proven statutory violations or documented instances of a quid pro quo. The guardrails of the American legal system held.
And I look at that exact same data set, and I conclude that the unprecedented scale of foreign investments, the sovereign wealth entanglements, and the new global ventures fundamentally compromised the appearance of independent decision-making.
The appearance?
Yes, the appearance, which matters. It revealed the dangerous inadequacy of our existing transparency rules. The legal guardrails didn't hold. They were simply bypassed because they weren't built for a vehicle of this size.
Okay, let's start at the foundation, looking at the very beginning of the era outlined in the dossier, because this is where the original departure from historical norms occurred, back in the 2015 to 2021 period, and we need to understand the mechanics of it.
Sure.
In 2017, the incoming president made a defining structural decision regarding his assets. And before we debate the ethics of that decision, can you walk us through the actual mechanics of what previous presidents did?
I can do that.
Because the term blind trust gets thrown around constantly in the media, but what does that actually mean in practice?
Well, it's a crucial mechanical distinction. Historically, going back to the post-Watergate era, modern presidents sought to eliminate any potential conflict of interest by establishing what we call a blind trust.
Right.
The mechanics are fairly simple. You take your assets, let's say a diverse portfolio of stocks and bonds, and you hand total control of them over to an independent financial trustee.
An independent third party.
Exactly. And you have absolutely no communication with this trustee about the assets. The trustee then typically liquidates your original holdings and reinvests the money into a broad, diversified portfolio.
Hence the blind part.
Right. The blind part means you, the public official, literally do not know where your money is invested. Therefore, When you are sitting in the Oval Office making regulatory decisions or signing tax legislation, you cannot intentionally act to enrich yourself.
Because you don't know what companies you actually own.
Precisely.
Right, like Jimmy Carter famously put his peanut farm into a blind trust to avoid conflicts regarding agricultural policy.
Exactly. And the expectation in 2017, established by decades of normative behavior, was that the incoming president would do something similar.
But he didn't.
No. He opted against total divestment. Instead, he handed over the daily operations of the Trump Organization to his sons, Donald Jr. and Eric, while retaining complete legal ownership of the company.
Right.
And that establishes the foundational disagreement of this entire era. Whether the highest office in the land requires structural separation, meaning total divestment in a true blind trust, or if mere operational separation is sufficient.
And this is where I really want to inject some market realism into the conversation.
Okay.
Because the criticism of that 2017 decision always struck me as fundamentally impractical. We have to acknowledge that the concept of a blind trust was designed for highly liquid assets.
It's easier with liquid assets, yes.
It works beautifully for stocks and bonds because you can sell them on an exchange in milliseconds. It was not built, nor is it practically feasible, for a complex, globally branded, highly illiquid real estate empire.
But the illiquidity of the assets doesn't negate the ethical requirement to divest. It just makes it harder.
It doesn't just make it harder. It makes it economically destructive. I mean, let me use an analogy here. Forcing a generational real estate mogul to liquidate their empire into a blind trust over a transition period of, what, 10 weeks?
About that, yeah.
It's like forcing a master shipbuilder to burn their entire fleet just to prove to the town that they won't favor their own boats once they become the harbor master. A real estate developer cannot blindly trust properties that have their name in giant gold letters on the facade.
I understand the branding issue.
Right. If you own a skyscraper in Manhattan or a golf resort in Scotland, you can't put it in a blind trust and pretend you don't know you own it. The only option is a forced fire sale of a multi-billion dollar portfolio, which would result in a catastrophic financial hit.
But
that effectively serves as a massive, punitive financial penalty simply for winning an election.
Well, if you choose to run for the presidency, you are choosing to subject yourself to the highest ethical standards of public service.
Sure.
The financial hit, while unfortunate for the individual, is the price of admission to a position that holds the nuclear codes and the power to regulate the global economy.
But if we demand total divestment of non-liquid, generational family businesses, look at the systemic outcome of that.
Which is what?
Aren't we essentially declaring that only career politicians or individuals with highly sterile, easily liquidated stock portfolios are allowed to hold high office?
Not necessarily.
Doesn't that contradict the fundamental American ideal of the citizen legislator? We are essentially saying that a wildly successful business builder is inherently disqualified from public service unless they actively destroy the very enterprise they spent their lifetime building.
I wouldn't call it destroying.
A fire sale is destruction of value. Operational separation, putting the sons in charge of the day-to-day decisions, was the most realistic, pragmatic compromise available at the time.
The flaw in that theory is that operational separation proved to be entirely insufficient for the protection of institutional integrity.
How so?
Well, the Associated Press provided a very thorough historical analysis that is cited extensively in the Bridge Suisse dossier, confirming that this broke with all modern precedents. By remaining the legal owner, the president directly benefited from every single dollar spent at his properties.
But he wasn't managing the properties.
He didn't have to manage them to profit from them. And we aren't just talking about average tourists buying a round of golf here. We were talking about domestic lobbyists, foreign dignitaries, and special interest groups booking entire blocks of rooms at the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, was located mere blocks from the White House.
And that brings us right to the Emoluments Clause, which became the primary legal weapon used by critics during this first term. For listeners who might only know the term from cable news cryerins, let's break down the mechanics of that.
Good idea.
The Constitution has two Emoluments Clauses. The domestic one prevents the president from receiving any compensation from the federal or state governments beyond their salary.
Right.
And the foreign one, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 8, prohibits federal officials from accepting gifts, titles, or emoluments of any kind from foreign states or their representatives without the consent of Congress.
Correct.
And the framers of the Constitution wrote that foreign clause specifically because they were terrified of European monarchs subtly bribing early American diplomats with gifts.
Right, the old snuffbox example.
Exactly. They understood that influence isn't always a briefcase of cash. Sometimes it's a diamond-encrusted snuffbox, or in the modern era, a million-dollar ballroom rental. Yet, despite years of intense investigations by groups like Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, CREW, and myriad congressional probes between 2017 and 2021, the legal architecture held.
It survived, yes.
There was no smoking gun, no federal court issued a final ruling that the president was actively trading American foreign policy for hotel bookings. The lawsuits largely floundered on issues of standing or just became moot.
But that's a procedural victory, not an ethical one.
You are identifying a theoretical vulnerability, the fact that foreign officials stayed at the hotel. But you are lacking a factual, proven betrayal of the national interest. A family does not lose its right to participate in the free market simply because the patriarch holds public office.
I think relying on the failure of the CREW lawsuits completely misses the point about institutional decay.
How? It's the law.
Because the courts struggled to process these lawsuits because the emoluments clauses had never been tested in this specific corporate way. The legal architecture of the United States was designed to stop a diplomat from accepting a horse from a king. It was simply not designed to process a president who operated a global corporate hospitality network.
But the law is the law. If you don't break the statute, you are operating legally.
No, the fact that the court struggled to define the exact parameters of the emoluments clause in real time doesn't mean the ethical firewall wasn't breached. It just means the legal system was too slow and conceptually ill-equipped to handle the breach.
I disagree with the premise that it was a breach.
Let's look at the mechanics of influence then. If a foreign government wants to influence a career politician, they have to rely on traditional, highly regulated diplomatic channels, or perhaps try to influence a political action committee, which is heavily scrutinized.
Sure.
But if a foreign government wants to influence a president who retains legal ownership of a global hospitality brand, they don't need a PAC. They just book a ballroom for $1 million. They rent out a floor of a hotel and leave it empty.
Which is a standard commercial transaction.
But the money goes directly into the corporate revenue stream, which bolsters the overall valuation of the company, which directly benefits the owner. The operational separation didn't stop the money from flowing. It just meant the sons were the ones depositing the checks.
Okay, but that friction you're describing between domestic optics, theoretical influence, and actual legal breaches, that dynamic fundamentally shifts when we look at the post-first-term landscape.
It certainly does. It escalates.
The dossier explicitly highlights the period starting in 2021 as a massive escalation. Because when the family transitions back into the private sector, we move from domestic real estate and hotel bookings to international geopolitics and sovereign wealth funds.
Right.
And the prime example cited in Chapter 22 is Jared Kushner, a former senior White House advisor, founding a private equity firm called Affinity Partners and securing a staggering $2 billion investment from the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund, the Public Investment Fund, or PIF.
Which is the ultimate realization of every fear the ethics experts harbored during the first term. To understand the gravity of this, we have to look at the timeline and the mechanics of sovereign wealth.
Okay.
Kushner handled highly sensitive Middle East policy during his time in the White House. He was the point person. He developed incredibly close personal relationships with the Saudi leadership.
He did.
Then, almost immediately after leaving his public role, he forms a brand new private equity firm. And 6 months later, that firm receives a $2 billion injection of state capital from the very foreign government he was just negotiating with on behalf of the United States.
I want to pause right there, because I understand standard private equity, but for listeners who might just see Saudi PIF in a headline, walk me through how a sovereign wealth fund actually operates and conducts due diligence.
Sure.
Because my understanding is that these are massive return-seeking financial vehicles, not just slush funds for political favors.
Well, sovereign wealth funds are state-owned investment funds comprised of money generated by the government, often derived from a country's surplus reserves. In Saudi Arabia's case, it's heavily fueled by oil revenues.
Right.
The PIF is tasked with diversifying the Saudi economy away from oil by investing globally. Now, standard private equity investments by the PIF go through a rigorous, multi-layered internal review process. They have internal financial experts, screening panels, and risk assessment boards.
Like any major institutional investor.
Exactly. Their job is to look at a potential investment, like a new private equity fund, and evaluate the track record of the managers, the potential return on investment, and the public relations risks.
And the dossier notes there was internal friction regarding the Affinity Partners investment.
Massive friction. The dossier highlights that the PIF's own internal screening panel actually objected to the Kushner investment.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The financial experts cited concerns about Affinity Partners' inexperience as fund managers, the potential for public relations risks, and an unsatisfactory due diligence review regarding their actual operations. They essentially looked at the mechanics of the fund and said, from a purely financial standpoint, this doesn't meet our rigorous standards.
And yet, the overarching leadership of the fund overrode those concerns and approved the $2 billion allocation anyway.
Exactly. And how does a political leader structurally override a financial panel? By exerting unilateral state power. The Crown Prince, who chairs the PIF, essentially bypassed the financial guardrails.
That's his prerogative as the chair, though.
But this is where the mechanics of influence become terrifying. If the internal financial experts are saying, this doesn't make financial sense, and the political leadership says, do it anyway, you are no longer looking at capitalism. You are looking at shadow diplomacy.
Shadow diplomacy?
Yes. You are looking at a foreign state actor monetizing a public servant's past actions and placing a down payment on future American foreign policy, assuming the family might return to power.
I mean, that introduces a level of teleological reasoning we have to be very careful with. Assuming the outcome proves a corrupt intent.
It's not an assumption. It's looking at the sequence of events.
Let's look at the actual mechanics of the private equity industry, though. Private equity is heavily, almost exclusively reliant on the network, the access, and the geopolitical understanding of its founders.
Sure.
You are saying Affinity Partners lacked experience, but who on earth had a better, more current understanding of the geopolitical and economic landscape of the Middle East in 2021 than Jared Kushner?
Well,
he literally helped architect the Abraham Accords, which fundamentally reshaped the economic corridors of the region.
But he built that network using the power of the American government.
That is a secondary point to the market valuation. From a purely objective investment standpoint, if you are a sovereign wealth fund looking to deploy massive amounts of capital in a way that navigates complex international markets, Kushner's Rolodex and his strategic structural insight into regional dynamics are legitimately worth billions.
I disagree that it's secondary.
It's intellectually dishonest to look at a successful private citizen leveraging his legitimate, hard-earned expertise and label it shadow diplomacy just because of who his father-in-law is. And let's be clear on the legal reality here.
Okay.
Kushner was a private citizen by 2021. He was no longer a government employee subject to the Hatch Act or federal conflict of interest statutes. It is absolutely not proven in any legal forum that this investment was a delayed quid pro quo.
Legal proof and ethical breaches are two different things, as we've established.
But Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE are sovereign wealth titans. They invest everywhere. They own massive stakes in Silicon Valley tech firms, European infrastructure, and American sports. Affinity Partners is a legitimate financial vehicle operating in a space where political and financial acumen naturally intersect.
You cannot seamlessly divorce his expertise from his government service. That is a fiction. His Rolodex, as you call it, wasn't built through decades of grinding in the private sector.
It was still built.
It was built while he was serving the American public, drawing a government salary and utilizing the immense weight, leverage, and military power of the United States government to open doors that are closed to ordinary bankers.
But that happens all the time.
To immediately turn around and monetize that specific public service with a foreign state actor is exactly what degrades institutional trust. It sends a glaring message to every future public servant. Use your time in office not to serve the public good, but to build relationships with foreign wealth funds because the payoff on the private side is in the billions.
But wait, let's look at historical precedent. Because it is entirely legal and incredibly common for former officials to enter the private sector and monetize their government experience. It happens in every single administration, regardless of party.
The scale is different here.
Is it? Four-star generals retire and immediately go to the boards of major defense contractors. Secretaries of the Treasury step down and go straight to Wall Street investment banks or hedge funds, leveraging the exact regulatory knowledge they just implemented. Why is the Trump family held to a completely unprecedented purity test standard that we do not apply to any other sector of the American political corporate revolving door?
Because of the sheer scale, the direct involvement of foreign sovereign wealth, and the continuous ongoing political ambitions of the patriarch.
Unpack that for me.
When a general goes to a defense contractor, it's problematic, yes. But that general isn't generally planning to run for president again in 4 years, potentially bringing that defense contractor's financial weight and influence with him into the center of the political ecosystem.
Then let's examine that specific political corporate ecosystem, because the period between 2024 and 2026, as outlined in Chapter 22 of the Bridgethroughs dossier, sees an explosive expansion of the family's business interests directly intersecting with their political ideology.
This is a critical period, yeah.
The dossier details how Donald Trump Jr. became a partner at 1789 Capital. Now, for context, this is an investment firm explicitly profiling itself as an investor in America First businesses, creating what they call a parallel conservative economy.
Right.
Under his involvement, the firm's assets under management ballooned from roughly $150 million to over $1 billion.
And simultaneously, as Reuters and other global media outlets reported, the family ventured deeply into cryptocurrency, NFTs, and expansive global real estate projects in places like Oman, Vietnam, and the wider Gulf region.
Massive expansion.
The financial disclosures from this period show hundreds of millions extending to over $1 billion in reported income from these new diversified streams.
Which I view as brilliant, highly responsive market capitalization. Donald Jr. and the family tapped into a massively underserved market.
You see it as just market strategy?
Absolutely. Think about the cultural climate of the mid-2020s. There was a whole ecosystem of conservative America First businesses that felt actively locked out of traditional, perhaps more progressive or ESG-focused Silicon Valley venture capital and Wall Street financing.
They felt alienated.
Right. They needed capital, and they wanted it from aligned investors. The growth of 1789 Capital from $150 million to $1 billion in assets doesn't reflect corruption. It reflects immense, pent-up consumer and investor demand. The family simply innovated to meet that demand.
I think innovated is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
The same goes for the cryptocurrency ventures and digital tokens. These are modern, decentralized revenue streams. If millions of Americans are eager to engage with digital finance, why shouldn't a high-profile family capitalize on their brand in the digital age? It is standard capitalism.
It is not standard capitalism when the individual driving the fund is inextricably linked to federal power. We have to look at the media consensus across the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times, which the dossier meticulously cites.
What do they conclude?
The scale and the structural overlap here are entirely unprecedented. Let's break down the mechanics of 1789 Capital. You have a massive private equity fund managed by the president's son investing in domestic companies.
Right.
Now, walk through the mechanics of government contracting. The federal government issues RFPs, requests for proposals for everything from defense logistics to border security technology. What happens when a company heavily backed by 1789 Capital bids on a massive federal contract?
They are evaluated by career procurement officers based on the merits of their bid.
In theory, but human nature and bureaucratic self-preservation play a role. When the son of the sitting president is controlling a $1 billion fund in an America First parallel economy, the boundaries completely collapse.
I don't see how they collapse if the process is blind.
Because it's never truly blind when the brand is that big. How can a mid-level government procurement officer at the Department of Homeland Security make a truly objective decision about awarding a highly lucrative contract if one of the bidding companies is financially tethered to the president's family? The subtle, unspoken pressure is immense.
If you're listening to this and wondering how we differentiate between a good investment and a corrupt one, you have to look at the actual Reuters financial disclosures the dossier relies on.
Let's look at them.
If a massive portion of the American electorate supports America First policies, deregulation, reshoring manufacturing, border security, then a fund supporting businesses that do those things is just good, rational capitalism. It is meeting a market need.
But the conflict...
Are we to assume that every single one of those $1 billion in assets is inherently tainted just because of Donald Jr.'s surname? If a logistics company is providing a fantastic service and 1789 Capital invests in them, and then they legitimately win a government contract because they are objectively the best vendor with the lowest price.
People will still question it.
Exactly. Critics will cry foul simply because of the familial connection. That creates an impossible anti-capitalist standard where the family is effectively barred from domestic investment entirely.
It's not an impossible standard. It's the fundamental normative standard of avoiding conflicts of interest in a democratic republic.
But they're private citizens.
The burden of proof in a functioning democracy shouldn't just be on federal prosecutors to prove a statutory crime beyond a reasonable doubt. The burden should be on the public officials and their immediate proxies to proactively prove their absolute impartiality. With 1789 Capital, the blurring of ideological branding with corporate scaling means that political loyalty is being directly monetized.
But let's look at the international expansion during the same 2025 to 2026 period. Oman, Vietnam, these are legitimate massive real estate developments.
Yes, they are massive.
The dossier mentions the significant international attention these projects received. The Trump Organization was an international real estate developer for decades before 2015. They build luxury resorts. Why should they artificially cap their corporate growth in emerging markets just because of the political timeline?
Let's break down that zoning example, because doing business in emerging markets like Oman and Vietnam involves deep, unavoidable entanglement with the sovereign governments of those countries.
Just like anywhere else.
No, it's different. Real estate development in these regions isn't just about buying a private plot of land and quietly getting a standard zoning permit from a local city council. It requires navigating complex, state-controlled bureaucracies, partnering with sovereign wealth entities, and securing high-level political approvals from the central government.
Which is true for any major multinational developer operating in those regions, from Marriott to Hilton.
Yes, but Marriott doesn't control the United States military or dictate American trade tariffs.
That's a fair point, but...
When the developer is the family of the American president, the mechanics of influence change entirely. How does a foreign government use infrastructure to effectively bribe a developer? They don't hand them a briefcase of cash.
No, they offer incentives.
Instead, the government of Oman might grant a highly restricted zoning exception, or they might agree to build a $50 million highway and water pipeline directly to the site of the new resort, saving the developers tens of millions in infrastructure costs. That is effectively a massive state subsidy.
But how does that affect American policy?
If the U.S. Treasury or the State Department is simultaneously drafting trade regulations or arms deals regarding those exact countries, the American public has absolutely no way of knowing if a favorable trade deal is being engineered to return the favor for that zoning exception or infrastructure build-out. Every regulatory approval granted by a foreign government to a Trump property becomes a potential lever of geopolitical influence.
But again, the historical data contradicts that assumption of corruption. There is no evidence in the dossier or in the congressional record that U.S. foreign policy toward Vietnam or Oman was materially altered to secure a building permit or a highway for a golf resort.
Because it's almost impossible to prove intent on a trade deal.
You are identifying a theoretical vulnerability, a potential lever, not a factual betrayal of the national interest.
The vulnerability is the betrayal of the institution. Let me use an analogy that gets to the heart of this structural issue. Imagine a referee in a major high-stakes sports match.
Okay.
Now, imagine that referee's family runs a massive billion-dollar betting syndicate that is heavily focused on the very games he is officiating.
I see where you're going with this, but a referee isn't an elected official facing voters.
Hear me out on the mechanics of trust, though. Even if you cannot prove, even if investigators scour the game tape and find no definitive evidence that the referee threw a specific call to benefit his family's bets, the integrity of the sport is utterly destroyed the moment he steps on the field.
Because the perception is tainted.
Exactly. The fans will question every single whistle. The players will lose faith in the fairness of the game. The broadcasters will debate his motives endlessly.
Right.
The independent experts, constitutional scholars, and former government ethics officials cited throughout the Bridge Thews dossier are essentially saying, We need to change the rules for future referees. We need structural firewalls, precisely because this 2015 to 2029 era exposed a loophole so wide you could drive a billion-dollar private equity fund and a global real estate empire right through it.
That brings us perfectly to the philosophical core of our debate, which elevates these specific historical facts, Kushner, 1789 Capital, Omen, into a high-level discussion about the core institutional norms of American democracy.
It's the crux of the issue.
The dossier draws a very explicit, crucial distinction. Ethical questions do not automatically mean statutory violations. This is the ultimate debate of legal reality versus the appearance of conflict.
It is.
I stand firmly on the defense of the rule of law. In a legal system, we require proof of a crime. If no federal statutes are broken, if the emoluments clauses are not technically violated in a way that courts can prosecute, we cannot retrospectively punish a family based on subjective appearances.
But the law is merely the floor of acceptable behavior, not the ceiling of presidential ethics. A president is supposed to aspire to the ceiling.
That is a lovely idealistic sentiment. But in a republic governed by laws and a constitution, the floor is literally all we can enforce. Anything else is arbitrary.
Arbitrary?
Yes. The critics' argument, as we've seen throughout this discussion, relies almost entirely on a presumption of guilt. You assume that because foreign capital was involved in a sovereign wealth fund, it must be corrupt shadow diplomacy. You assume that because a billion-dollar domestic fund existed, it must be exerting undue influence on government procurement contracts.
Because the structural incentives point that way.
But look at the political reality of this era. The American people voted in 2016 and again in 2024 with full transparent knowledge of this massive, complex business empire. The media reported on it endlessly.
They did.
The Reuters financial disclosures were public record. Therefore, this appearance of conflict wasn't hidden. It was culturally and politically litigated at the ballot box, and it was accepted by the electorate. The voters decided that the economic growth and the policies delivered were worth whatever theoretical vulnerabilities existed.
Electoral victory does not absolve ethical decay. Just because a populace becomes desensitized to a glaring conflict of interest or decides to prioritize other issues at the ballot box does not mean the conflict ceases to exist mechanically.
It doesn't cease to exist, but it's validated.
A leak in the foundation of a house is still a leak, even if the homeowners vote to ignore it. The dossier notes that many ethics experts and constitutional scholars argue that if our existing American transparency and ethics rules cannot account for a president with a global, multi-sector enterprise spanning real estate, private equity, international licensing, and now cryptocurrency, then the rules themselves are dangerously, hopelessly outdated and need to be rewritten for the modern era.
Outdated or perhaps functioning exactly as intended to prevent the overreach of an administrative state. Think about the alternative. If we start legislating or prosecuting based on appearances, who exactly gets to define what a bad appearance is?
Independent ethics bodies.
But they are appointed by politicians, the political opposition, a partisan committee. That is a terrifying recipe for weaponizing the justice system against successful private citizens and their families. The Trump family proved during this 14-year period that you can navigate the highest office while practically delegating a sprawling, illiquid business, and you can simultaneously innovate into new, modern sectors without breaking the law.
It is not weaponizing the justice system to demand that the President of the United States and his immediate family not have a direct financial stake in the regulatory decisions he oversees.
Which decisions, specifically?
We haven't even fully unpacked the cryptocurrency aspect. When the family pivots heavily into crypto and digital tokens in 2025 and 2026, as the dossier outlines, generating hundreds of millions of dollars in new revenue, we have to ask about regulatory capture.
The crypto market was booming for everyone.
How does that directly impact federal regulatory policy on digital assets? During this exact period, agencies like the SEC, the Treasury Department, and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission are making defining generational rulings on how crypto should be classified. Are they securities? Are they commodities?
And the president advocated for a deregulatory approach, which the industry wildly supported.
Exactly. But if the first family is heavily invested in NFTs and launching their own digital tokens, it exerts an immense gravitational pull on the regulatory apparatus.
It's just policy alignment.
You can't regulate an industry objectively when your personal family wealth depends on those specific asset classes pumping in value. It's the very definition of a moral hazard. If the SEC chairman knows the president's sons are launching a coin, is that chairman going to aggressively enforce the Howey test on similar digital assets? Of course not. The regulatory agency becomes paralyzed by the political proximity of the asset.
But let me give you a different perspective on the crypto space, because I think it proves my point about market synergy. The financial disclosures were made. The public knew the family was involved in crypto.
Knowledge doesn't fix the conflict.
If the regulatory agencies make decisions that benefit and deregulate the broader crypto market, yes, the family's assets might increase in value, but millions of ordinary American retail investors benefit as well. The Trump family's alignment with emerging market trends like cryptocurrency or America First domestic manufacturing isn't inherently corrupt. It's entirely synergistic with their explicit political platform.
Synergistic?
Yes. They ran on deregulation, digital innovation, and economic nationalism. Their family businesses simply reflected deregulation, digital innovation, and economic nationalism.
Which perfectly illustrates the complete and utter blurring of the lines. When the political platform and the personal business portfolio are perfectly synergistic, the public can no longer distinguish between a policy made for the good of the nation and a policy made to inflate the family trust.
I think the public is smarter than that.
The dossier's conclusion highlights this exact open question. To what extent do these business interests actually influence policy decisions? We may never have a documented quid pro quo. We will probably never find a signed contract saying, deregulate crypto and we will launch a coin to make $50 million.
Because it doesn't exist.
But the structural alignment ensures this family profits immensely from the specific policies they enact.
And my overarching argument is that this alignment is a feature of their worldview, not a bug of corruption. They believe in capitalism. They practice capitalism. To expect them to halt all commercial enterprise, liquidate generational assets, and sit in a sterile financial vacuum for 4 or 8 years is naive and, frankly, un-American in its restriction of free enterprise.
I disagree that basic ethics are un-American.
The legal reality of the 2015 to 2029 era is that the emoluments clauses were investigated ad nauseum. The financial disclosures were scrutinized by every major media outlet, and the system held. The guardrails didn't break. They were just subjected to the ultimate stress test.
The guardrails didn't hold. They were bypassed entirely. When you have foreign sovereign wealth injecting $2 billion into a family member's fund over the objections of their own internal financial panels, the guardrail didn't hold. The car drove completely off the road into the desert, and no one in the American legal system had the jurisdiction to write a ticket.
That's a dramatic interpretation.
The international reactions detailed in Chapter 22, the massive investments flowing from Qatar, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, the real estate deals in Oman and Vietnam, they all point to a global geopolitical understanding that the American presidency had essentially been financialized. Foreign actors, particularly sovereign wealth funds, adapted to the new reality much faster than American ethics laws did.
You are assuming those investments wouldn't have happened anyway. Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds diversify heavily. They invest in the biggest names in American finance constantly. Kushner built a legitimate firm that offered them a bridge into American private equity.
With the $2 billion first-time fund, let's be real about the mechanics of finance here. That scale of initial capital is practically unheard of in standard private equity for a first-time fund manager, regardless of their domestic connections.
It's rare, but not impossible.
Unless those connections are distinctly, undeniably political in nature. They weren't investing in a track record of financial returns. They were investing in the architecture of influence.
Well, let's pull back and synthesize our positions in light of this extensive, incredibly detailed discussion. We've covered a massive 14-year arc from 2015 to 2029, looking at domestic hotels, international real estate, sovereign wealth, and parallel economies.
That's a lot to take in.
It really is. My view, synthesizing the evidence and the legal baseline presented in the Bridge Twist dossier, is that this era proved a fundamental, enduring point. A business family can maintain their legacy enterprise, they can innovate into cutting-edge sectors like cryptocurrency and America-first ideological investing, and they can navigate the highest office in the land without breaching established legal statutes.
That's certainly the legal argument.
The delegation of daily operations to Donald Jr. and Eric worked practically. The expansion was a triumph of market capitalization and private enterprise reacting dynamically to consumer and investor demand.
And my synthesis of this exact same historical text is that this period revealed a gaping, catastrophic hole in our democratic guardrails.
Right.
The unprecedented influx of foreign sovereign capital, the blending of political influence with commercial enterprise and massive funds like 1789 Capital, and the scale of overseas real estate development fundamentally eroded institutional trust.
In your view?
It proved, definitively, that relying on the letter of the law alone is wildly insufficient to protect the ethical integrity of the presidency in a globalized hypercapitalist era.
But I think there's a clear point of convergence here, regardless of our ethical interpretations. We both agree, and the dossier explicitly concludes, that the combination of political power and massive commercial activity during this era was entirely exceptional in modern American history. It had no precedent.
Absolutely exceptional. It completely reset the normative baseline. Future historians and legal scholars will not just look at the dollar amounts generated between 2015 and 2029. They will look at how the fundamental norms of the office, the expectation of divestment, the definition of conflict of interest, were permanently altered.
Exactly. The baseline moved. We remain deeply divided on the nature of that alteration, obviously. I view it as a triumph of private enterprise, a necessary modernization of the citizen-legislator ideal for the 21st century, and a victory for the rule of law over subjective ethics.
And you view it as a crisis.
Yes, you view it as a crisis of public ethics, a failure of transparency, and a dangerous financialization of the executive branch.
A structural crisis that we will be analyzing for decades to come, especially as the long-term geopolitical effects of these global investments and the regulatory overlap in sectors like crypto fully materialize on the market.
And as historians evaluate those broader institutional consequences, there is so much more granular detail to uncover in this monumental project by Bridgetos, Ties. This debate over the Trump family as a business empire and the mechanics of their expansion is just one piece of the puzzle.
A very big piece.
Huge. If you found this breakdown of Chapter 22 compelling, you should definitely look forward to the project's future releases. I want to specifically tease Appendix E, the annual update 2030-2035, the Living Trump Dossier, which will track exactly how these newly established norms, or lack thereof, depending on your view, evolve in the coming decade as these financial vehicles mature.
It will be genuinely fascinating to see if future administrations, regardless of party, adopt this financialized model, or if the pendulum of public opinion swings back violently toward demanding stricter structural divestment.
Indeed. But until then, we are left looking at that skyscraper we talked about at the beginning. The physical firewalls are still there, structurally speaking. The statutes and the laws remain on the books.
But the doors are open.
But whether those open doors between the floors are letting in the fresh air of free enterprise and modernization, or the slow, suffocating smoke of institutional decay, well, that is a judgment left to history and to all of you listening.